My name is Howard Olson. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. And I've been leading these discussions here all week on the environment and the relationship to forestry and our other natural resources. So I'd like to start with a light word, and the session starts. And it reminds me of my friend Jack Vesey, who became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under the Reagan administration. And after he got down to Washington, he was telling all these corny Swedish-Norwegian jokes from Minnesota around Washington. So his boss called him in one day and he said, "Jack, you know, you better watch it on these ethnic jokes, because sooner or later you're going to see yourself on the evening television and you're going to offend a lot of people." So he said, "If you want to keep telling those jokes, you've got to pick some race that's no longer on the face of the earth, like the Hittites." Jack says, "That is really a good idea, so I'll use the Hittite thing." And then he got ready to tell a story, and he said, "These two Hittites were walking down the street, and Sven said to Ole." Well, Sven had bought a truck, and he wanted to go commercial with his truck, see? So the state had him down to take this exam, so they were giving him some hypothetical situations. They said, "Sven, you're coming over the hill, and there's a really steep mountain thing there, and at the bottom, suddenly your brakes give out and you're really racing, and at the bottom is a stalled freight train across the intersection there. What would you do?" He said, "I'd reach over and wake up Ollie." He said, "Why in the world wake up Ollie?" He says, "Well, he's never really seen a big accident." And then Sven got kind of old, and he and his wife, they got to the stage in life where they were both after one another all the time. It was this and that, and life was getting unbearable at home. So Lena said to Sven one day, she said at breakfast, she said, "I wish the good Lord would call one of us home to heaven. Then I could go live with my sister." Okay. A good friend of mine in Minneapolis, a woman who's working for a PhD, told me, about 2 months ago, she had just taken a 3-day symposium on environmental ethics. So we're going to cover the 3 days in 50 minutes here. She brought me a bunch of her reading material and her references that they used for 3 days of a study of environmental ethics. And I'm just going to begin by reading this list to you to tell you the type of references they use in that type of a study in this day and age. Because part of it is also geared a little bit to feminism, which we're all in favor of here at Holden, at least. This list has got about 20 references. It starts out with the Bible, Genesis 1-3. Then Lynn White's book, The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. Third one is Aldo Leopold's, The Sand County Almanac, which is from our library here. I told a group a few days ago that a survey was made of all the leading forestry colleges and foresters in America as to what reading materials influenced them at a very young age to think of going into conservation and natural resources. This book was on about 90% of the list, so it does come very well recommended. It's excellent reading, too, and easy reading. John McPhee's Encounters with Archdruid, New York publication. Here's a feminist view, about three of them, one by Corlin Bush entitled Women and the Assessment of Technology. Elizabeth Dodson Gray, Man Above the Anthropocentric Illusion from Green Paradise Lost. And Charlene Spretnak, Lost Goddess of Early Greece. Then they go on, The Northern Cheyenne Tribe and Early Development in Southeastern Montana. Over there on the book, on the table, there's a very large book on the recycling plan for the state of Montana. Daughters of Copper Woman, the Vancouver, BC Press. The Man Who Killed the Deer by Frank Waters, 1942. Gary Snyder, Poems and Essays from Turtle Island, 1974. And then some concepts of nature. The Idea of Nature by Collingwood. Traces on the Rhodian Shore by Glacken, and then the shift kind of back to another age, Mountain Gloom and Mountain Glory. You can tell some of these are a little different, the order of things from New York, Howard Jones, Oh Strange New World, The Age of Energy, Stephen Fox, John Muir and His Legacy. He's the one who founded the Sierra Club, I think you all know that. And Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and Why Your House May Endanger Your Health, and Beauty, Health, and Permanence, Environmental Politics in the United States, 1955 to 1985. I just give you that as an idea, and I have a few extra copies of that if any of you are interested in the type of list that they use for that short course. What I'd like to do tonight, just to set the tone here, since we're talking about ethics and we're at a Christian retreat center, I'd like to have you get your thinking into the kind of a higher plane on the trade-offs here. Ethics has many definitions. If any of you'd like to give me your idea of what ethics are, we can discuss. But there are two main types of ethics. One is the practical type, and the other type is the kind that you make the ethical decision based not on what it's going to do or how it's going to affect anything around it. It's a pure ethical decision. You don't consider all the trade-offs. You just think about what is proper, what is right, what is fair and honest and ethical. So you've got these two types of things, and I'd like to have you, in your thinking this evening, just kind of keep those two things in mind as we look at the what could be the issues here. As we go along, then, I'd like to give you some suggestions. You've all been reading newspapers. I guess this time maybe I'll just show you. This is my collection from about 4 days of newspaper clip-outs. And I show you this because we are now getting publicity to all the environmental issues that were kind of swept under the rug for many years. The last 7 or 8 years, it's really coming at us day by day. And we see things like this in USA Today, Chemicals Next Door, and Peek at the Love of the Canal. Here's, I'll just read a couple of these. Environmental slashes at the Capitol. I've been on a number of committees trying to get more money for environment. And when these state legislatures get down to the wire, the money seems to drift into other causes. EPA reports effects of global warming, and that's getting more publicity as it should. Scientists tell Congress the greenhouse gas buildup is increasing. Earth First members begin a tree sit-in to protest logging. Chained himself to the truck, I guess. Ozone damage to grain, often severe, the scientists find. And that's what we were pointing out the other day, that the effects of acid rain and the ozone damage will really get attention when it starts affecting agricultural crops, because it's a fast thing that you can recognize. When your yields per acre start dropping, it gets everybody's attention. In forestry, it's a little different situation. Public needs to know about nuclear plants. Big one, Love Canal again. Toxic disasters are possible here. More and more communities are looking at where they're at on toxic disasters. So, showed the group this the other day, Oh Beautiful, for oil leases. Of all the difficulties right around Yellowstone Park, there are about eight different things impacting on Yellowstone right around the perimeter of the park, even though it burned last year when we were talking about this. But all there are developments coming right up to it. They're building condominiums right at the line. There's geothermal testing going on and leasing. There's mining exploration. There's logging. In fact, that picture is a picture here of clear cutting right up to the edge of the park. Oil and gas, large oil and gas tracts have already been leased. A rise in energy prices could spur major drilling activities at Yellowstone. The dams, up to 9 dams would be built on the Clarks Fork River in spectacular wilderness under the Wyoming plan to increase water supplies. Airport jets land daily in the midst of the Grand Teton Park. Attempts to move the airport were stymied by former Interior Secretary James Watt. who granted the airport a 50-year lease. A church, this is an interesting one, a new church put their new headquarters for Church Universal and Triumphant right at the boundary of Yellowstone, right near one of the gates. And the ski areas and condo development, ski runs, degrade the habitat. So we're getting now plenty of publicity to what we're all talking about. This magazine, Rudy, from your collection up there, very new, The Planet Strikes Back. And there again, we're getting some, now we're getting a better grade of information. A while ago, it used to, you'd check all the information, the things you really knew something about. In my case, about the wood supply and the forestry, I could see that the people who were writing were not fully informed about what they were writing about. But now I think we're getting better assessments of all the things that we're talking about. This deals with all the things we're thinking about here this evening. The soil, the water, the energy, the forests, and the quality of life, which I put up here. Now, does anyone want to make a comment as to how they'd like us to spend, direct our thinking and talking here? We've got many things we can go into, but we don't have time to cover the whole waterfront. Anybody got a particular question in mind or something they'd like to hear talked about and get some opinions? Well, we don't want to spend too much time at night, but certain species, such as Douglas fir, need sunlight. You want a regeneration, you want to have recycle the forest. You can't expect to get regeneration in the shade. In Minnesota, we have a species called aspen. Suddenly that aspen is very much in demand because it's being used for strand-oriented hardboard. And the way aspen grows is from as a root sprouter. You don't have to plant it. It grows like mad. But you do have to clear cut in order that it gets sunshine to come up. Otherwise, we end up with a brush.
Selective cutting doesn't work?
No, not with aspen. Not for regeneration.
How about fir and hemlock?
Fir and hemlock. Anybody want to comment on fir and hemlock? You want to?
No. Well, there's two things that it goes in clear cutting. It's a cheaper way to go, and it also does open up the areas for replanting. And the biggest concern is, of course, the brush and things that come up. And it's difficult to get in there and selectively log an area. It'd be almost impossible on the hillsides and so forth. They've almost got it started one end and just cleaned it out. They attempt to leave the trees in the area for reseeding. But I know warehouser's practice was always to go in there and replant immediately.
I kind of question the areas that I've seen, not all of them, but I've seen areas that are clear cut and they've been that way for years and the young growth hasn't been coming back.
Okay, a lot of that is before the law was changed. The laws have changed now. And most clear-cutting is being replanted, whether it's on private land or on public land or Forest Service or wherever. Is your objection mainly aesthetics? It doesn't look nice? Okay.
It looks like a mangy dog.
Well, there's a few mangy dogs around, anyhow. I don't know. No, clear-cutting is a big issue, no question about it. And Ansel says there's certain reasons why they clear-cut, and there are scientific reasons. The best answer to it, I just came back from Sweden and Norway, and there they clear cut, but they have excellent programs of replanting. They have intensive management of all their forest stands, and they clear cut, and you can see stands that are 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, and they have a rotation of about 60 years, and then they clear cut and replant, and that's the way it is. Timber's a crop there, and they manage it that way, but they have very intensive management. Some of the cases you're saying about is they didn't have. You know, 30, 40 years ago, there are a lot of areas in the Pacific Northwest that really need to be replanted and remanaged. And there are some back in the Midwest, too. But the land is getting more expensive. The land base is shrinking. So we have to plant more, and we have to have intensive management, forest management. Excuse me, Ron had a question in the back.
I'm still reacting to your...
This thought just came to me early in the afternoon, you know, along with clear-cutting, this idea of exporting... logs is also a red-hot subject all over the United States. just came to me, what about all the logs we've been importing from somewhere else for many, many years? We don't seem to worry about that. Philippine mahogany and then the hard mahogany from Brazilian hot mahogany. And we think that's really neat, you know. We pay them well for those logs. Well, the Japs are paying us well for ours, too, but we want it to be a one-way street.
Exporting is a big issue in other parts of the country as well.
The issue is out here. Everybody's looking out here. This is where the main logs are coming from. But it's on everybody's mind. There's a lot of southern pine exported every year, too, but they're not in the form of huge, beautiful logs. They're exporting a lot of wood chips that are already put in the chips. Norway's got all the paper mills, and they don't have enough wood fiber anymore, and they're buying from the south coast of the United States. Mm-hmm. Nobody thinks there's anything wrong with that. One of the things that we don't realize is that the politicians don't mind seeing it happen because it helps the balance of payments. One of the heaviest exporting items we've got is timber and logs. But the state, when you talk to the third world countries, they want more value-added activity in their own state or in their own country. That's why, like Venezuela and these others, they can't export logs. They've got to do the final thing they can do with it in their own country. And I was in the wood preserving business. They don't even want it shipped untreated. They want to treat it in that country, then ship it.
Well, that would help if we did that, too. We could still export
our more logs. Jobs. More jobs, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right now, yes. In the state of Washington, we're having difficulty keeping the smaller mills operating because of the exportation.
I think our federal government could have helped us, too. I know we dealt with the Japanese early on, and we sent finished product over there, but it was very, very difficult. And I know we were very willing to accept things from Japan with no import duties on it, or very small. But we were shipping some products over there where it was a 70% import duty. And that makes it pretty tough.
That's probably why Japan is the richest nation in the world.
Yeah. They're buying us. Yes.
I just want to suggest another general topic that I'd like to hear people sort of express their ideas on. Because when I look at the crisis, it seems to me that the model there is very much people-oriented, totally focused on people and their spirits and their souls and their well-being, you know, their illnesses. And
which crisis is?
Christ.
All right, well,
okay.
Excuse me.
I see Christ being almost exclusively people-oriented.
Okay.
And how do I relate that to, you know, being concerned about the physical world?
Sure, we can, you know, put world hunger in there.
Say, let's take all the resources we have and, you know, feed everybody and get everybody well. And, you know, I'd like to hear what other people have to say about that and sort of trade-offs.
Yes. Excuse me. Go ahead.
I would much rather, instead of us sending money to foreign countries.
Well, they got the money to buy it, though. I was talking to a guy from Chile. He says, you know, you can't have a capitalistic system if you don't have any capital.
We're sending the money. Why not send the products?
Okay.
Yeah.
Put them on our charge account.
Yeah, right.
Well, what they're saying here on this, where is it? Debt for nature swap is that we should give up some of our third world debt. Tell Mexico we'll swap you for 100 million, 100 billion, what do they own? 40 billion, swap them for some oil or something to Mexico.
I think it's a good idea.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes?
When the Japanese were complaining about importing logs, they said, make it in metric and we'll buy it. But they don't want to handle metric.
The interesting thing about Japan is they're the greatest timber market in the world right now.
Paper mill over in Port Angeles.
Oh.
It's a pulp mill, excuse me.
They like to stay close to the coast.
It's a Pacific Rim. It's kind of ideal.
Mm-hmm. Is there any activity to control the clear cutting so that we have a recyclable situation such as you described in Sweden? Or is it just kind of run amok?
No, there's a lot of activity. Even Weyerhaeuser can't maintain their lands the way they might prefer to do it, just looking at the bottom line, there are state regulations. There was a fellow here last year that was on the Forestry Planning Board for the state of Oregon, and they review their plans every 2 years, and there are a lot of situations there that impinge on the private industrial landowner, and then the non-industrial private landowner comprise about 40% of the timber reserves of the United States. And that's a group that they don't need to cut their timber particularly, but they control a lot of it. So they're trying to get at that source too, because they'd like to have it.
Private citizens, you mean?
Yeah, they're just not industrial forests. They're not 5,000 acres. They're just
small.
But that's an astounding fact that they own 40% of the...
Oh, like somebody has 100 acres?
Yeah, tree farmers. The tree farm movement's got... In Minnesota alone, we got 13,000 tree farmers. Mm-hmm. And I think the national total is something like 67,000 or something. People that own anywhere from 10 to 50 acres and on up. Yes?
We did see one sign on the Olympic.
Weyerhaeuser just planted their 2 billionth seedling, if you can imagine that. They were starting to plant seedling when I was in forestry school 40 years ago. The U.S. government, because they have to get all the appropriations and the budget and everything cleared, they haven't done as much planting as some of the private organizations have, even though they're planting plenty of trees. And I was going to mention what we think, what can we do as an advocate for some of this? We're only one person or one group. In Minnesota, I'm president of the Minnesota Forestry Association, and Arbor Day, we sponsor a seedling situation. We have fifth graders that buy seedlings from us for 40 cents, and they're little organizations, they sell them for a dollar a piece. Last year, we sold 87,000 seedlings, and those trees all get planted because those kids like to do it. And next year, they're predicting about 1 million. So that's just a small thing. We started about 5 years ago, but if every state was able to do a little thing like that, you can see what happened. It could be done in Sunday school. It could be done by church youth groups to raise money. Mm-hmm. We buy those for about 20 cents, and we sell them for 40. They make a profit. We make a profit. Everybody wins, including my grandchildren 50 years from now.
There's a place that you can pick cones, bring sacks.
Oh, yeah.
And get paid.
Cone picker for seed source.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I saw a notice in the paper where you could send $10 to the Arbor Day organization, and you'll get six trees, blue spruce, they were.
Okay, now that's a United States organization that is facing the worldwide situation with timber, that we need to be planting more trees. I didn't even put the Brazilian situation up here tonight because that's a whole story of its own. They're logging off Brazil, it's burning off, and everything bad is happening down there. Our tropical rainforests are disappearing at the rate of, 800 square miles a year?
80,000.
Square miles. 80,000 square miles a year. And they're showing that we need the trees that take in the carbon dioxide and emit the oxygen. So it's no longer just a U.S. situation. It's worldwide.
I think that's a good illustration of where we could take the third world debt and give credit for land,
sure,
for trees that are not burned.
Mm-hmm.
We could pay for the oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
You work it out?
But see, that assumes it'll sell on Wall Street. That's my basic premise.
I know what you mean.
Legislation.
How much can you cut before it really makes a difference? How close are
worldwide?
How close are we worldwide to...
Well, here's a couple of books I showed him the other day, Reforesting the Earth. This is a recent publication, 1988. They've got some encouragement in here. This one was written in 84, Air Pollution, Acid Rain, and the Future of the Forests. This group does an excellent job of researching, and I can just read you a note here from the conclusion on this one. It says that... tree planting may lack the glory and the grandeur of a medical breakthrough, a huge hydropower dam, or any number of technological marvels, but its unmatched potential for stabilizing simultaneously the carbon cycle, land and water resources, rural energy supplies, and people's livelihoods makes it a top priority for economic and social development. Covering the equivalent of 130 million hectares with forest by the year 2000 would entail successfully establishing some 18.4 billion trees annually. The target sounds staggering, but it would only require each person now living in the third world to plant and care for 5 seedlings a year. Reforesting the earth is possible, given a human touch. And as you said, Wall Street's got to buy it too. Right? Yes, Rudy.
Yeah, Howard, I'd like to point out too to the people here that we try to do things in Holden which we can replicate in other places. And one of the things we're really working at here in this wonderful property that we have inherited is to reforest it, in a sense. Because as you look at the pictures of the village as it was in 1957 when the mine closed, there were no trees in this whole area. And there was virtually no grass. And now we have beautiful lawns, and we just look at these trees that are on these lawns. You know, they were planted by us. And within the last 25, 30 years, you see, we've got good-sized trees here in the area. And we've completely, in a sense, changed the environment, removed a good part of the scar, and with proper watering and feeding, these things are changing very rapidly.
Good forest management, intensive management, really grows trees fast. Ron, tell them about that tree, your trees and your property out there. Oh, I'm really impressed with that.
About 20 years ago, we planted a hedge. What we intended to have is a hedge of Douglas fir in our backyard, and they were either cones or seedlings. They varied, but nothing more than a foot high. And 20 years later, we have this hedge that's grown 40 feet high.
Sure. And what's the rotation on Douglas fir, like 90 years? 80 years? And it's ready for harvest. That's why timber managers, that's why they want to cut down trees. They don't want them to go over mature, rot on the stump, you know, and die and fall down. That's why they want to, when they're mature, they want to remove them, plant new trees that'll come. Now, the people that are opposed to clear cutting and regeneration say, but about the third time, you're going to lose the nutrients in the soil. You may not get the kind of reproduction because you haven't got all the dead timber and things like that. That hasn't been proven one way or another yet. Minnesota is working on their third forest now. And they were the big cutovers around 1904 to 1910. The northern white pine was cut, and it was cut again, and now it's coming up again. Let's see, somebody else said, you had a tree you planted that 10 years got so big you had to cut it down?
Yeah. But I planted some of these little super trees.
Super trees?
What they are, they picked out the better cones, and they isolated them, and then they get about a 2 or 3 year seedling, and they've been giving them away. And it was ridiculous, that thing grew a foot and a half or 2 feet each year there for a while. And they have planted some stands of this type of tree.
For you, those of you who haven't been here this week, there's been a lot of really good work done on forest genetics. They're coming up with some better crosses of species that grow faster, better, and straighter. And she said they call it the super tree. And there are some good breakthroughs in some species, like aspen has a 40 to 60 year rotation, what they call a life or maturity. And they've got one now that may be able to do it in 40 years instead of 60. Well, that, you know, triples your ability to produce more timber and more of everything on the same amount of land. The other reason for clear cutting in Minnesota, it really helps the wildlife. The deer population's gone way up because they can reach it and eat it. That 90-year rotation thing reminded me of George Burns when he had this big review on television, you know, his 90th birthday, extravaganza. And they said, George, we can't imagine how you got to be 90 years old and everything. He says, I can't either. But he says, there's one thing about it. There's nothing I could do at 18 that I can't do today. There's a big blank look on everybody's face. And he says, that shows you how wretched I was when I was 18. That may be true of some trees, too. Well, listen, let's decide which one of these we'd like to talk about for a while. Get some of them off of here. What do you think, these questions like this, does wildlife take precedence or priority over forestry? Does water take priority over the forest? Does water take priority over wildlife? There are a lot of interesting give and takes like that that are going to come up sooner than we think. In the next 5 to 10 years, there are going to be some really big issues right on our morning breakfast table.
Yeah, I think water and air are critical.
Water and air. This matter of lifestyle, nobody wants to talk about what their own personal sacrifices are going to be. We don't want anybody fishing in our waters, but we don't mind fishing in theirs. Exporting polluted air, we do export that a little bit to Canada. Exxon, here's the ethics comes into play. The bottom line, the bottom of the boat. They had agreed many, many years ago they'd have double bottom boats up there, tankers, and the one that crashed wasn't double bottom.
I understand that legislation failed when they tried to get it through.
Right.
Our own two state senators voted against it.
They also had to keep Alyeska strong and viable. The whole industry did.
Getting closer to home, on the evening paper yesterday, Hatfield said, despite the spotted owl, he put a tag on a bill in Congress that they're going to have to be able to harvest, I think it was 5.1 billion board feet this year and the same amount next year. Forest Service said we can't do it if we have to live up with the Fish and Wildlife Service told us about the spotted owl. And he said you'll have to settle that some other way. This is the way the bill's going through. So there you get when push comes to shove on a lot of these matters, and that's the kind of questions we're all faced with. I'm sure he did a lot of soul searching on that.
We have an issue actually right in our backyard in the Seattle area, in the Darrington area, a lot of you may know about it, where there's been a lot in the papers about the spotted owl and cutting down the climax forest, which is what the spotted owl uses as habitat, versus the folks who make their living as people who cut, you know, as loggers in that area. And, you know, I would have always initially, it gets very complicated if you really want to think carefully about it, because when I was in college or whatever, and anyone had presented this issue to me, I would have automatically said without much thought, well, of course you can't cut down this forest. Of course you have to save the spotted owl. And then I've been reading more and thinking a lot more about a lot of the letters to the editor that have been in the local papers by people's families who are supported by the logging industry, who have said, that brought up the very sort of issues. What's more important to us? Is it my survival? Is it my family's survival? Or is it the spotted owl's survival? And I think to myself, well, really, what is more important? And are we thinking short term? Are we thinking long term? You know, what's our responsibility as stewards of the earth? And I don't know the answer. I'm just saying that it's becoming much more complex and much more difficult to think about.
That's right. It's becoming very complex to think about. And that's why I think it's good that all you people are bringing this to the front of your thoughts even this evening, because as you get back home, sooner or later you'll be called to exert your leadership, your influence, and your ethics, and your morality, and everything else. They're not simple matters, they're very complex. But they need addressing. And some things are going to get hurt, you know.
Mm-hmm. If you go to a country that's already cut down all their logs, like some of the countries in the third world, and you see that they have always gone on the policy that survival is the first and most important thing, and yet they have used it up.
And a lot of those people in the third world need the twigs to eat their food.
That's right.
Leading to starvation.
They've cut the branches right up to the top of the tree.
That's right. The best example of reforestation in the whole world right now is South Korea. After the war was over in about 1952, 53, the hillsides were denuded there completely. And the University of Minnesota had a joint venture through the government with the South Korean government, and they planted there, and I've seen slides from fellows that have been back there 10 and 15 years later, and it's just like a miracle. But somebody has to take the initiative and get that started in all of these third world countries. And several of the third world countries in Asia are selling their, well, Africa's a big one. They're cutting down trees as fast in Africa and selling them to Japan as they are in Brazil. And they just can't afford to do it. The term is desertification. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't come back at all. It turns into desert.
That's right. That's what I've seen.
So how can we as Christians in this part of the world, how do we get around to exerting our influence, whether it's on water, on air, on the timber supply, and the world hunger situation? It's the type of thing that we, I think, are duty-bound to struggle with. And if we're in a position at all where we have some influence, we should be attempting to use it or influence other people.
Seems to me the only way we could touch on that point would be through the missionary effort.
Well, anybody else want to comment about that? Can we do it through missionaries? Art Holtze, who's here, you know, is retired from the Soil and Conservation Service, just spent 2 years in Papua New Guinea helping them with their water supplies and things of that nature, and I think he did a lot of good, but here we are in 1988, and they were just so primitive over there, he couldn't believe it. And I'm sure he and his wife did a lot of good there in the 2 years they were there.
But he's the first to admit that because what he did was to deal with individual tribal interests, and the central government was denying these activities but not enforcing of them, that there's been almost total regression already just because of the infrastructures of the tribes and their lack of willingness to cooperatively work together, which again suggests that our role there or anywhere else is to be legislative advocates, painful as it may be and as unpleasant often, but to get something in place that people eventually will get used to and tolerate first and perhaps willingly accept later.
So it's, what do you conclude from that?
As long as we're sinful and unclean, we'll go our own way if we're allowed to, and we need to have that Saturday night bath whether we want it or not.
Hot shower and a warm bed. Pardon me?
I'm sitting here thinking there must be some worldwide organization through which you could work, because I don't see how America can have that much impact, or how organized Christian missionaries could have that much impact in the third world. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but for some reason, the World Health Organization just jumped into my mind, and I thought, gee, maybe through something like that, which has contacts in all the third world, and monies for, and very committed people for educational programs and changing things, you know, they've been able to eradicate smallpox and things like that. I'm just wondering, kind of searching around in my brain for an organization like that that would have a worldwide impact in terms of education and change.
One of these publications mentioned that that is one of the most optimistic thing that is happening, that there are a number of good organizations, Rudy, you know this too, on some of these worldwide studies that are going on, and they have had some breakthroughs. They're in the early stages, but things are happening, but the problem is so immense, you know, that you wonder how, if we're going to get there in time, I guess that's what we're all talking about.
I guess I'm encouraged because my fifth grader and seventh grader, if they go to the grocery store with me, I throw an absolute fit if I forget and buy one of the aerosol cans. I must buy pump cans and roll-on deodorants because of the ozone layer. And they are very, very aware of that.
That's because education has educated them in the schools. And that's the same thing with all these matters. In Minnesota, they've got a law that they have to have environmental education in the third, fourth, and fifth grades. And they've got it well funded. And I've given talks to those kids. They really are working at it. And what a difference.
Yeah, I think that I feel hopeful. Because
that's why when you talk to the fifth graders about planting seedlings, they know what you're talking about.
I heard an interesting discussion on the ozone layer. A man from the University or Oregon State was talking to the Rotary Club. And he said, the thing is, we're always talking about a temperature change. And he said, can you imagine how difficult it is to get the temperature around the world he said, we have very little data on the oceans, and think how much of the country or the world is covered by water. Mm-hmm. And he said, take Seattle. For a long time, they took their temperature downtown. Now they're taking it out the airport. We poured all these concrete runways. So he said, we see a change in temperature. But he said, we really can't at this time tell you if that's a significant change. But he said a change of 2 degrees would be enough to start melting the glaciers, and we could have a major runoff. But he said, as far as we're concerned, at this point, they think it's about a 2/10 1 degree change. So yeah, it is very significant. And it's, I can understand the difficulty of trying to gather all this data and prior to having a computer, how to analyze it.
Well, yeah.
One of the hopeful things is that these satellites that are going around are now giving us temperature data worldwide. And so you can't tackle a problem well until you know what the facts are. Yeah. And that's one of the difficult things to gather. But hopefully we're doing this. And it'll take time. But you see, we have not had good measurement records for, except for the last few years, you know. And we're just starting these things. So the important thing is to support it wherever you can. And each of us can support it in some way.
Walter, would you like to say anything about water? Just a broad statement, but...
Well, I guess I'd raise more of the question that you touched on about the priority of water over wildlife. I think that the issue is more not one being greater in requirement than the other, but how do you come up with balanced solutions without either one of them being called priority?
Okay, well, that's the same type of criteria they're trying to work with in forest management. You take all the five factors, and recreation is a big one. Aesthetics is another big one. Wildlife, watershed, the timber, they call it the non-timber uses. We're no longer making up forest management plans that only talk about growing fiber. That's a thing of the past, and everybody thinks that's in the Middle Ages really right now by the thinking. And that includes private industry as well as government and everything. We're dealing with a whole new generation of people who see things the way they ought to be seen. Thank you very much. We got just a couple of minutes to go, so I want to conclude, and before I do, I'm going to read a final paragraph here on ethics and consideration. This is a very good paper. It's written on steps in ethical decision-making. It deals with health, but we're talking about the health of the world, and it touches on some of the same things. But a thought came to mind when you were introducing yourselves here. A fellow was introducing me one night, and he said, Olson has reached the metallic age. I thought, boy, I wonder what's coming now. And he says he's got silver in his hair, gold in his teeth, and lead in his shoes. In concluding, I'll read this last paragraph. So often hands are thrown up in despair of the words, I don't see how you could think that way. One aid to understanding could focus on the how of thinking and deciding. If we are willing to grant each other the right to fill these various steps with our own content, we could journey along the path together and understand how we might very well arrive at different places through different decisions. So you see the complexity. Thank you all very much. Thank you.